speed up my my talk a little. In respect of the other two speakers, I'll use 15 minutes and not overstep the mark. And I will do that by not reading my paper, except the first quote. I try to memorize it, and it freaks me out. If the contemporary airport offers us laboratory conditions for the analysis of global interconnections in the information age, then perhaps it's an early warning system for what happens in the rest of the world on the network globalization. That's a quote from Fuller and Harley's book. I do not have copyright. I do not make money of it. It's a very interesting book. It's Aviopolis. And interesting, Rob walks away, I would have done the same thing. He gave a talk on this book in London last week, so apparently we're having found a way to waste so much taxpayers' money for me to come here and talk about that book and for him to go there and do something. I think we could have cut this out, right? And, yeah. So, and I'm cheating as well. This morning I woke up and thought, we can't just stand in front of these people. Just do this other talk. I had to have some notes. The paper that I want to give today, I wasn't allowed to give because the airport security officer asked me what my business was, and I said, you know, could I come and do a paper here? I said, you know, you're not allowed to bring in any trade tools without having them signed up. So basically, I can't give a paper because that means I've I'll keep the paper. Thank you very much. But my interest lies in risk and has been for a very long time. And in particular, I want to talk about risk flows today. And I do this in sort of reminding us of a concept of flow that's been around a bit, and Deleuze is, of course, made it famous. But we in space and culture have a little bit to add to that as well. The concept of risk flow, for me, was introduced to me by a guy named Ian Roderick, who was a colleague of Penny's at Waterloo. And Ian talked about Victorian household and how several flows have to be separated. And this is from water and gas to start off with, but also from food and waste, and of course the domestic servants from the occupants of the house. And they all have to be separated. Flows. And so the idea of contamination is when flows cross without them actually being regulated. And one of the things about airports is, apart from spending a lot of time in airports being an academic, which is something that my friend Simon, who is also an academic but he doesn't work at university, derides me about, saying, you know, you spend so much time in airports, where is your reality? And he's right. My reality is that of airports. So thinking, well, you know, you spend so much time in airports, why not just turn it into project. So so it's an ethnography, autoethnography. I'm trying to share this with a number of people to develop a research project. So this little talk will also be kind of testing the water a bit for now, what ideas about research are. I'm glad Erin did her paper, because I was going to talk about society of control and about pure war and about the state of emergency, and I don't have to do all those things, so thank you very much. I'm going to talk about the state of exception, though, as kind of a play on Agamben's idea that the airport presents itself as the state of exception, but it's kind of a very permanent form of exception. If you get to the only airports, actually, will you be treated like that? Fuller and Harley will argue in their book that this is not the case. They say this is the way we will all be treated in the near future. And it ties in quite a bit with some of the talks in the morning, some of the talks yesterday. And the hypothesis I'm going to throw out, and I could stop the paper after that because it's only a hypothesis, is that with all this sort of emphasis on data mining and algorithms and intelligent agents and all these connections between the several systems of information processing, our subjectivities become more and more marginal to the way in which power works. And so a lot of talk about resistance around starts to sound a bit strange. And you know, you wonder what kind of resistance is viable. And I would say, do not do this in an airport. Okay, that's not a wise thing, because it is a state of permanent exception, and so nothing works there. Right, so I want to talk about risk flow. And risk flow has two dimensions for me. One is, it's a continuum of translations. And I was going to do performance piece, which is not working because I'm too nervous. But I was going to ask you, shout the risk, right? And I'll do a risk flow analysis of it. I'm not going to do that. Because there are too many clever people here. I'll get a risk I can do anything, I can't do anything with. Until I get stuck in a food processor. So I will do bird flu. Yes, show that this risk flow applies to anything. I'll show something that's so recent that I can't possibly have practices for very long. Because I was doing BSc all the time, right? But BSc is so old. It's, oh well, you know, we've heard that before. So I'll do bird flu. And when you look at bird flu, as a media, kind of just the structure, if you like, of things that come to mind. And these things, I would argue, operate in translations of risk or risk flows. And peculiar things are there that from the start of bird flu, you can separate at least two trajectories along which these risk flows evolve. And the first one I want to sort of bring in immediately, which is the personal. What if I'm from Europe, I just came from Europe a couple of days ago. What if I got bird flu? I hear my sniff. My sniff and my sneeze and my cough travels at least 10 meters. So. Welcome to my world. But because the Greeks have bird flu, and the Turks have bird flu, and Europe is close, right? So a personal risk thing. Now you become kind of neurotic. And, but there's a, that's the thing I can do least with, apart from the fact that I'm not equal to Penny in that kind of work. So no, let Penny do that kind of work. Much better than I am. So I'll go to the second type of flow, which is institutionalized. I know most about that because I'm a student of Ulrich Beck, and that was Ulrich Beck's strength, if you like to talk about institutionalization of risk. And the thing that Beck does not argue, and I think it's because he's so bored with risk he doesn't want to argue it anymore, is that institutionalization of risk actually transforms what the risk is about. And I'm trying to get Ulrich to accept a non-linear paradigm here, whereas I feel that he's using kind of social science and sociology as an excuse to stay within the safe limits of what you could say Anthony Giddens' world, or whatever, the world of sociology. I'd say, now let's move beyond this, let's go to a non-linear paradigm, and let's say how these institutions not only change in the nature of how risk is perceived, but change actually the nature of risk. And I don't mean this metaphorically, I mean this literally. Risk transforms, literally. I know Jan was actually in a warning this morning about Deleuze and his sort of biologism. I'm afraid I'm guilty as sin. I'm a total biologist. And so when was Robert today did a thing on parasites, I was asking myself, you know, is he talking about endo or exosymbiotic parasitic forms? I didn't ask the question, I thought it's colonizing you for me. But I'll go back to the institution. So it changed the nature of risk. And with bird flu, it's quite difficult. With BSc it's quite easy because you can see them in different moments because it evolved out of time. Bird flu, everything seems to come at once. Birds fly in, birds fly out. But you can clearly see the implications here. Because the first type of implications deal with public health. And there may be a public health problem here. And so governments have to prepare. And so they prepare in various ways. And you can see how this then becomes a risk flow. So they prepare, for example, let's stock up on this antiviral drug that we know works, which Hoffman or Roche has bought the patent of, and are very slow to manufacture very quickly, according to the experts. And they've been very slow for a long time. But the original patent holder wants to withdraw the patent writing because Hoffman and Roche is making a mess of things. For Hoffman and Roche, clearly, now there's the pressure is on, the risk is on, that they, apart from making loads of money in their sort of responsibility to shareholders and the risks involved in not delivering, also have a public responsibility because they don't want to be seen as mean, nasty, global pharmaceutical capitalists. Who wants to be seen as that? Right? So it's a fairly obvious kind of marketing risk you may be involved in, for example. And Hoffman Roche are big, right? They can screw a lot of people, but they can't screw everybody. And I think they operate in that kind of very intelligent world. So they run a risk here, but so do various governments run risks. And one particular one I want to pick up on is whether to act early or act late. And the timing of action is a clear risk moment here. Because if they act too early and they start to, for example, create hospital beds specifically designated to treat people with bird flu, they will automatically not then keep those hospital beds for other things. So they're kind of opportunity risks involved. You can see this further happening, of course, in relation to politics and political risks, where the politician who stuck his or her neck out to say bird flu is the next big thing may be proven wrong. Right? It could happen. Now, there's a great quote, right? Read my lips, no new taxes. It did the old man in, I'm afraid. So you have to be careful as a politician to what kind of risk you side with. If you're too late, of course, you're immediately accused of touching the issue being too late. It's never a good thing for a politician, except if you can blame it on someone else, like Europe. And then there's a whole third stream of risks involved, which has to do with economics. And this has to do with the killing of lots and lots of birds as a prophylactic or a preemptive strike in Congolese's register to stop the flu from traveling. Now, there's very funny things going on with birds, but if they can fly. You know, you can of course tell lots of birds that you have contained in a particular domain, and that may stop chickens from getting bird flu because there are no chicken left. But it's difficult to do with wild birds. They tend to move on. And then there's a problem with local wild birds as well, who may or may not move on. And you know, what do you do if you're a swan in Romania? What will you do? I wonder. The point there is, of course, that some risks are not containable. And I'm telling my wife, who's very scared of bird flu, and this is genuine, right? Because she said, if this comes here, right, they say 15 million people, no, 50,000 people in Britain, which is 0.1% of the population, are likely to die from it. So it's a serious problem. Now apparently has given me the answer, of course, duct tape and plastic. Cover up the orifices of your house and be safe. These lessons come in handy again. Right, so duct tape and plastic. However, there's one bird that they haven't put in this risk equation, and that's a big bird, a multiple carrier of things, lots of diseases among other things, and lots of other things as well. And it doesn't have a particularly patterned travel route, right? Because with migrating birds that, you know, that are suspected of having bird flu, they travel from sort of Middle Asia across Eastern Europe towards Africa. But these birds, they just fly everywhere. But they have schedules. Now, they fly on schedule, if you're lucky. But they go everywhere, and they go everywhere relatively quickly. I mean, they can fly the globe in 24 hours, the big birds. And I was wondering, you know, what that has to do with risk assessment. Why is it that in Europe we seem to be now gearing up to bird flu, and here we aren't? And I thought, well, yeah, maybe it's because this big bird is not seen as part of some sort of natural constellation. However, there are people in it, not only English-Dutch hybrids, there are also Greeks on it, and Romanians, and people who may have handled poultry as well. So at the entry point, where the state of exception emerges, of course, we will soon find, as the bird flu hits people, that Canada will put in its protective measures for your security, and you can be safe, that they will stop bird flu at the end point of entry, you hope. So this is all about translations. I've noticed I've only done one line, and I'm already running out of time. So no, it wasn't a good way to save time. But there's the other thing of risk, which is the switch. And the switch of the risk flow is that every risk can become an opportunity. Now, the insurance industry tells us that a lot of times. Usually they don't tell us it's an opportunity for us, not an opportunity for them. But every risk entails opportunities. And once you start to factor in opportunity into the risk flow, you can suddenly see it's no longer a linear pattern at all. But now we're into a real kind of fractal of possible relationships. Now, try to manage that, and that clearly is not possible without very good modeling kind of devices. And that is why I believe that regardless of politics, regardless of George W. Bush or whatever, these kinds of ways of processing data, and algorithms, and intelligent agents, and coding apparatuses, and just the whole world that Anne embraces happily, I'm grateful. That whole world will help us sort out these fractals, because without them, we would be at a loss. There is a downside to this, of course. I haven't said anything about apples. I can't do it now in the time, and I won't do it because it's clearly time for questions. The point there is, what you see in airports, of course, it's not an exception, but a very organized way of organizing security. And what we see is that far from this, that the world will in the future is a completely digitized environment, we see that Negroponte's dichotomy of the molecular and the digital is a useless one. Right? We should think of it as binary. And I don't mean binary opposition, I mean binary in a non-linear sense of the word, that one, and it's the way that this morning's paper talked about the virtual and the actual, one amplifies the other. And the binary is a great way, because what happens is the ground on which you stand shifts as your sort of, conceptions change and your perceptions change. And what happens with these intelligent operations, and you can see them in airports, in the sense that they are a continuous process of sterilization going on as you move through. And these sterilizations are guarded by things like identity checks. And it was, I think, Mark Auge who said, there's no freedom of individuals without identity checks. And I thought that was a very profound point. But you see it in airports. There's not just that. There's also continuous tracking, continuous monitoring. And these do not require you to be, to think, to reflect. You don't. And to start, to stop them, because I've really taken my time here, to stop, as I was at JFK some years ago, and we were ushered from immigration desk to some guy at a very dark spot at the airport. And we walked towards him, and he sent us back to basically where we came from. And I thought, I'm an intelligent machine, and I want to make this flow a little bit smoother. So I said, listen, you know, your colleague over there tells us to go this way and you're sending us back. Maybe someone could tell him not to send us here. And he said, just walk away, sir. Just go, sir. And what he really said was, we don't need your subjectivity, sir. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you to everyone.